In addition to MCAST, a subscription to emedhome.com includes over 1,000 video lectures from the best EM conferences, with more added all the time. View on any device whenever and wherever you want. All this and so much more, including hundreds of CME credits each year for the low cost of only $99. emedhome.com. For 20 years, the homepage of emergency medicine. Subscribe now.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the February 2022 issue of EMed Home's EM Cast. This is Amal Mattu at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, and once again, welcome back. Hey, before we get started, I want to let you know about two really great upcoming conferences. First of all, March 23rd is going to be our annual University of Maryland Emergency Cardiology Symposium. It is a free conference. It's going to be live streamed. It's going to start at around 7:45 a.m. Eastern Standard Time and run until around 12:30 p.m. So it's a half day. Essentially, it works as our conference day. And for many other residency programs out there, it is their conference set of hours. Check it out. The website is going to be emergencycardiologysymposium.umem.org. Once again, emergencycardiologysymposium.umem.org. That's the website. You can take a look at the topics and you can register. Once again, it is free registration and it is going to be live streamed. It's going to be a virtual event and we're going to have some really great topics. The theme, by the way, this year is going to focus on risk management and medical malpractice in emergency cardiology. And even for the people out there that don't live in highly litigious areas and don't practice in settings like that, I think there's going to be a lot of really great stuff that you'll learn from attending that conference, stuff that pertains to misses and pitfalls and misconceptions in emergency cardiology, a smattering of different topics. The second conference I want to let you know about is our 10th Emergency Cardiology course. This is a course that I run with Dr. Aaron Sayal, who's up in Canada. This is a two-day virtual course, April 4th and 5th, and we've gradually transitioned the course into intermediate and advanced level electrocardiography topics. Again, April 4th through the 5th. It's going to be from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Check out the website at emcardio.com. And with that, we'll go ahead and move on to this month's EM Cast. We've got three great topics coming up. We're going to focus on an article that was recently written up in American Journal of Emergency Medicine that talks about the management of the crashing asthmatic patient. This is a really scary condition to deal with. You know, we deal with asthma all the time, but with really critically ill patients that are heading down the tubes who are looking for a tube. What do you do with those patients? So we'll talk to an EM critical care specialist about some pearls and pitfalls with regards to that condition. Then we're going to spend some time talking about a risk management topic against medical advice and informed refusal of care. That's a really, really high risk area in emergency medicine. And this is going to be a recorded lecture from our recent Crashing Patient Conference this past fall. And finally, we'll move on to a pediatric topic. We're going to talk about a relatively high risk topic, and that is pediatric diabetic ketoacidosis. I think we're pretty accustomed and comfortable with dealing with DKA in adults, but there's some slight revisions and important things to keep in mind when children come in with DKA, and we're going to go through a really nice review article that talked about that topic to keep you up to date about some high-risk pediatric critical care. So with that, let's go ahead and get started. Well, kicking things off this month, we're going to spend some time talking about kind of a bread-and-butter topic, but we're actually going to talk about the end of the spectrum. We're going to talk about the asthmatic that presents to the emergency department, but we're going to talk about the critically ill asthmatic, the diagnosis, the management, and what you do when these patients are starting to crash. Dr. Britt Long and some of his colleagues recently wrote a very nice review article on management of the critically ill adult asthmatic for American Journal of Emergency Medicine. And, you know, joining me to cover this topic is one of my colleagues, Dr. Mark Sutherland. Mark is one of the growing number of triple boarded people that are out there, certainly at university. He is trained in our combined emergency medicine, internal medicine, critical care 6-year program, and he's boarded in everything. He works part-time in the emergency department and part-time in the ICU. So we're going to be able to get the benefit of his, not only his emergency department expertise, but also get the experience of somebody who works in the ICU after we in the emergency department have taken care of these patients. And Mark, of course, takes care of these patients in the emergency department as well. So Mark, first of all, this is your first EM cast. So welcome aboard. And I hope to be getting you back for some more in the near future.
Oh, thank you, Amal. It's an absolute honor to be here. I'm what you might call a long-time listener, first-time caller, but it's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right. We'll make you a veteran very soon. So anyway, this is a fun topic. I like taking care of patients who have asthma and present with asthma exacerbations. It's, to me at least, it's one of those rewarding scenarios in emergency medicine where even during the course of your shift, you can usually turn them around and get them home. But of course, some of these patients come in very, very sick. And as the paper points out, about 10% of patients end up being admitted to the ICU, and 2% actually require intubation, no matter how good we are at working them up and giving them the standard treatments in the emergency department. So it's still worth talking about this. And I think it's important to make sure that we're all up to speed on the latest best practices. So let's go ahead and get into this article, first of all. So the authors start out by discussing some definitions. And one of the things that they talk about is that there are two main types of severe exacerbation, the fast and the slow. And I think intuitively, we kind of know about that, but I've never actually heard it specifically described or defined in the literature. Can you briefly tell us what those are and why we would need to even know that there is such a difference?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm right there with you, Amal. Actually, I haven't seen this described before, but I completely agree. It really fits with our anecdotal experience. So they talk about what they call the rapid and the slow asthma exacerbation. And they characterize rapid as being less than 6 hours of symptoms and say about 20% or so of the severe exacerbations we're going to see in the emergency department are of the rapid type. On the other hand, the other 80, 85% or so are the slow type. They can have symptoms for at least 12 hours. They said sometimes as long as 1 to 3 weeks. I don't know about you. I don't know that I've ever seen a patient that's had 2 or 3 weeks of symptoms. That would be a little bit much. But there's a pathophysiologic difference in terms of what's driving them. Typically, the rapid exacerbations are more neutrophil predominant, whereas the slow ones are more eosinophil predominant. That won't really affect our management necessarily in the emergency department, although it is germane somewhat to outpatient, you know, pulmonologists and folks because there are targeted therapies for certain types of, for example, eosinophil-driven asthma. For us, I think the main thing they do point out that is useful to us in the emergency department, which I think is a general good rule of thumb in most things in medicine, is the faster it happens, the faster we can typically turn it around. So if it's the rapid type, especially if the patient's really decompensated over the span of hours, those are the patients you really want to jump on, be very aggressive with your therapies, because if you can get on top of it early, you can often turn those folks around, as you alluded to, within a few hours, sometimes even depending on how sick they are, and how worried you are about them, even get them home. So the rapid ones, you really want to make sure you're aggressive early on with.
Fast on, fast off, if you treat them aggressively. And then if it's slow in onset, then it's going to be really slow. And I think our experience is that usually the people who end up needing to be admitted because they're responding so slowly, those tend to be the people that say, yeah, my asthma has been slowly getting worse over 4, 5, 6, 7 days or so. So it, in that sense, it kind of makes sense in terms of predicting whether they're coming in or going home. So let's say you do see one of these fairly sick looking patients with asthma. What would you say are the key features of the history and physical that you try to get as you're starting treatment, either getting the history from the patient if they can talk, or let's say that they're so sick they can barely even talk, and you're getting the history from the medics and family? What are the key things that you want to elicit in the history with these patients?
Yeah, absolutely. As you allude to, this is really one where you want to dial in the length of your history and physical to how sick the patient is. So the good news is it's mostly the things you would think of kind of intuitively. On the history side, it's your OPQRST or your old cars or whatever mnemonic you use. You're going to focus on kind of how long their symptoms have been going on. If there's a particular precipitant, sometimes that can be helpful. Really more for the outpatient management when they get discharged, see if they can kind of address that precipitant, how severe the symptoms are compared to prior, what treatments they've attempted at home can sometimes be useful. And then you're going to take a very quick history of their asthma. So are they on any home medications? Often their med list will kind of tip you off to how severe their asthma is, how hard to control it is. Have they ever been on non-invasive positive pressure ventilation or intubated? Ever been admitted to the ICU? Do they see a pulmonologist? If you happen to find PFTs in their chart, sometimes that can be helpful, although you certainly don't have to have them. And then the other thing on the history you really want to look for is, are there any symptoms that might suggest an alternative etiology? So classics would be like anaphylaxis, right? Do they have GI symptoms? Do they have skin symptoms? CHF, pulmonary embolism. There's another that's very easy to confuse with asthma, which would be vocal cord dysfunction, which I think has subsequently been renamed paroxysmal vocal fold motion or something. So you kind of want to try and tease out if there's something else that might make you think of an alternative diagnosis. And then from your physical, again, it's really the basics of emergency medicine. 90% of this is about the foot of the bed test. So as you know, I work primarily in an academic center. So the residents are often rushing straight to the bedside. And I'll usually take the first 30 seconds or so and really just stand by the door and kind of watch the patient from a little ways away. And of course, you're just looking for respiratory distress. Are they speaking in full sentences? Are they using accessory muscles? Things like that. The article points out their mental status and cyanosis. I think those are great points, but those are really far down the line. So if the patient's obtunded, if they're cyanotic, I think that's pretty obvious and you really kind of missed the boat by that point. And then, of course, the other thing on physical, primarily beyond the foot of the bed test, would be auscultation of the chest. So there, of course, you're going to be looking for wheezing. As we do like to say, beware of the silent asthmatic. So if the patient is not making much noise when you listen to them, that could be really good or really bad and nothing in between. So it might be that they're not moving much air and they're really sick. And then same thing on that front, if they're wheezing when they come in, but you go to reassess them later and they're not making much noise, do be cautious that that could be because they're getting better. It could also be because they're getting worse. And then similarly, when you're auscultating, I'll often take my stethoscope and listen over the neck as well. If you're hearing what sounds more upper airway, more like stridor, more inspiratory, that can be suggestive of vocal cord dysfunction as opposed to asthma. Again, those two are very hard to differentiate. And then as you're doing your history and your physical and your initial evaluation, obviously you want to be doing the EM basics. You want to be getting them on the monitor. Check a pulse ox. Just do be aware that hypoxia is usually a very late finding in asthma exacerbation. So if they're not hypoxic, don't be too reassured. If you can get them on end tidal, that's ideal. You're going to look for that kind of shark finning obstructive waveform. They have some nice diagrams in this article for anyone who has a chance to look at the text. They do mention in this article, which I also like, you can try and get a peak flow on the patient, but do keep in mind if they're really sick, they may not tolerate it. So I wouldn't push the point if the patient's not really capable of giving you a peak flow. You may also be sending blood gases, of course, although I think sometimes they're overemphasized in respiratory distress. They're not necessarily as important as your clinical assessment. And then you're going to get a chest x-ray usually for your sick asthmatic patients. They do also mention in the article point of care ultrasound. And of course, as you know, a lot of our colleagues are great ultrasound enthusiasts, as am I. Unfortunately, asthma is not necessarily a condition where point of care ultrasound is going to be super useful. Although if you have a specific question like pneumothorax or you're looking for an effusion, you're looking for pneumonia, you may want to grab your ultrasound machine while you're assessing the patient as well.
Fantastic. Those are some really great pearls. You know, I have to admit, I've never actually listened to the neck before, and I haven't heard somebody bring up this vocal cord dysfunction, but that is really interesting. And after today, I'm going to start doing that. So great. It's always great to learn something from these discussions that are not even necessarily in the paper. As I was taking notes, there's a couple of things that I wanted to highlight about what you said in terms of the differential. It seems like every year we've got at least one person who comes in with chest pain or shortness of breath, and invariably anybody who has a history of asthma always comes in and they say, it's my asthma. And when you do a good history and physical, you find out, well, normally asthma is more of a gradual onset over, you know, 20, 30 minutes or a couple of days. And this time my asthma started, bam, like that. And it turns out to be a PE. Or, you know, this time my chest tightness is just a little bit different and this asthma tightness is radiating down my left arm and it turns out to be an MI. I know at least once a year we have somebody who comes in with chief complaint, I've got my asthma acting up and it turns out to be a PE or an MI. So I think that differential you mentioned is really, really important. The vocal cord dysfunction, that's a new one to me. And then I really like the foot of the bed test that you talked about, how you just stand there and from the entrance to the room, you're watching for 30 seconds just to kind of gauge how sick the patient is, even before you listen to the lungs, because that mental status and the cyanosis is so important. And also other things we look for, if they're getting worsening tachycardia, worsening diaphoresis, those are really concerning. And I love the fact that you kind of downplayed the ABG. I know that people upstairs, you excluded, of course, are oftentimes really focused on the ABGs, but everything that you've described really points towards making clinical decisions on how the patient looks in terms of deciding whether they're getting better or worse, and not necessarily just focused on getting gases on these patients. And those are kind of painful anyway in a person who's already distressed. So those are some really great points you made. Thanks for doing that. All right. So now you've started the treatment process. What kind of things are you ordering for this sick patient and also watching for? You kind of talked a little bit about what you're watching for, but what kind of things are you ordering and watching for as we move forward now with this patient?
Yeah. So as we alluded to in the intro there, I think the good news is asthma is pretty bread and butter emergency medicine. I think most of our listeners are going to be familiar with some of the basics here, but obviously you're starting with your first line therapies, primarily beta agonists. So in the US, that typically means albuterol. There's some degree of debate about, you know, nebulizers versus MDIs with spacers and things like that. I think for the sick patient, most of us are more comfortable with a nebulizer. So I would really just start with nebulized albuterol. Typically, if the patient is either moderately or severely sick, you're going to want to be doing continuous. If you're unsure, just put them on a continuous neb and kind of see how they do. For the first round, you're going to also want ipratropium mixed in with it. So for most of us, the brand name for that is a duoneb. So usually that's kind of where we'll start. Do keep in mind the half-life of the ipratropium is quite a bit longer than the albuterol. So if you're repeating nebs or spacing them out to nebs later, usually you can just go with the albuterol. And then the other big thing on our first line is really the steroids. So that what exactly you're giving them can vary a little bit by practice pattern. We tend to use methylprednisolone. There's nothing necessarily magic about that. Do keep in mind if they're in respiratory distress, of course, you're not necessarily going to want to give them PO meds just in case you're worried about aspiration. So typically something IV. And of course, the steroids won't do you much good for 6, 8, 10 hours, but you want to get them on board as early as you can, just so you can have the benefit down the line of those steroids starting to kick in. There's an algorithm that they provide in the article, which I think is pretty good for anyone who has a chance to look at the text, kind of a graphic algorithm, how you walk down your lines of therapy. The other thing while we're talking about first line therapy that I will kind of politely push back on with the authors would be the IV fluids. I do think they make a very fair point. Patients in respiratory distress certainly can have significant insensible losses. In addition, the asthmatic patient may not have been eating or drinking very much, depending on how long they've been feeling poorly. So I think it's very possible and should obviously cross our minds that the patient might be hypovolemic, especially if they're hypotensive or there are other signs that you're concerned. The only reason I push back is when we're managing respiratory distress patients upstairs in the ICU, we like to say a dry lung is a happy lung. So we tend to run our pulmonary patients on the drier side, all else being equal. Now, that's more important, I would say, for like your acute pulmonary edemas, your CHF patients, the patients for whom the pulmonary edema is really the primary driver. And in asthma, airway edema is a bit of an issue, but it's not a primary issue. So it's not a huge problem. If the patient's hypotensive, if you think you need to resuscitate them, definitely go ahead and give them IV fluids. I just wouldn't necessarily do it automatically, depending on the clinical situation.
Well, that sounds like a fair approach. Now, the authors also bring up parenteral beta agonists, for example, epinephrine being the most common. When do you use intramuscular epi or even IV epi with these patients?
Yeah, the short answer is when the patient's really, really sick. And the other piece of that would really be if you have another reason to do it. IM epi, of course, the classic other reason you might have to do it is if you're not sure if it's anaphylaxis. The IM epi might help your asthma exacerbation as well. So that's not an unreasonable approach just to give them IM epi empirically. And then certainly if they're very sick, if they're hypotensive, and particularly if you're suspecting some degree of cardiogenic dysfunction, let's say you've done an echo and it looks like their squeeze is not very good, using epi as a first line pressor might be very reasonable because you get a little more bang for your buck out of it. Usually by the time we're down to things like, you know, epinephrine drips, you've pretty much saturated most of the beta receptors with your albuterol. Hopefully you're not considering IV epi until you've given quite a bit of albuterol. So honestly, the bang for your buck that you get is pretty limited. But yeah, if the patient's hypotensive, let's say we've been managing for a few hours, they're getting sicker, we've intubated them, et cetera, et cetera. And now I need to reach for a pressor. I might choose epinephrine instead of norepinephrine just for that reason. And then the other medication they mentioned is terbutaline. I've never used terbutaline in adults. I used it a few times in the PICU as a resident. And they mentioned in the article, the data for terbutaline is not very good. So typically for adults, I would not be reaching for that. In pediatrics, I would consult a pediatric intensivist before you are starting terbutaline. Usually if you are going to be starting terbutaline, we do trenbutaline, actually even in children, just because that can cause some cardiac ischemia. So you do want to be cautious about that. And again, the benefit is really quite limited.
Now, back when I was in residency in the early mid 90s or so, there was a lot of excitement about this new drug, new to us back then, at least. And now people use it for everything, and that's ketamine. And I would hear occasional reports where people say, yeah, they were going to intubate the patient. They gave ketamine as the induction agent and the patient woke up and they were fine. Well, maybe not quite that exaggerated, but they would say that ketamine really made a big difference. And also there was a lot of excitement back then about Heliox or helium oxygen mixtures. Now, interesting, ketamine still seems to be persisting, but I don't really hear much discussion about Heliox anymore. Do you guys ever use these in the ICU, or personally, do you use these in the emergency department?
Yeah, so ketamine, I would say, is similar to the discussion we just had about things like IV epinephrine. I would use ketamine if there's another reason to use ketamine. I typically don't just give ketamine for asthma per se, but if you've intubated them and you're looking for post-intubation sedation, or the other instance in which I think ketamine can be pretty useful is, and you've got to select the right patient, be very careful with this approach, but the DSI type maneuver where you're giving ketamine and you're putting patient on BiPAP or other non-invasive positive pressure ventilation, and you find that they just can't tolerate it without some degree of sedation. So you want to try and give them the best chance that you can of succeeding. Ketamine may be a reasonable medication to consider there, because of course it does have some bronchodilatory effects. You do have to keep in mind with ketamine, and I personally haven't seen a lot of this, so I don't worry a ton about it, but the literature does tell us that it can increase bronchial secretions a little bit, which is kind of the last thing you want if you're going to muck up that airway, and those, especially those lower airways, they can, you know, continue to have more plugging and make themselves worse. But personally, I haven't seen that with ketamine. As far as the Heliox goes, personally, I've never used Heliox. I think it's very institution dependent. A lot of it really is whether your institution has taken the time to set all this up logistically and kind of arrange all this with respiratory therapy and make sure that they know how to use it and can get it and all of that. There is some data that Heliox is useful. It doesn't have a mortality benefit, but I think if I recall from the article, it reduces length of stay, has some minor secondary benefits. So if you have it and you have easy access to it, you want to consider it. I don't think that's unreasonable. For most of us, I think we're going to find we work in institutions where we don't routinely use it. If you ask your respiratory therapist for it, they're probably going to look at you funny. And honestly, it's not really worth kind of making it your focus to get the Heliox. It's not going to do that much good. So I would really focus on your more bread and butter therapies like your beta agonists and such.
No magic bullet then. All right. So let's say that this patient's really not turning the corner. You're throwing everything at him that you've talked about already. And now you're worried that the patient is going to start tiring out in the next 5, 10, 15 minutes or so, or maybe, you know, over the short term, they're going to tire out. What are your thoughts about either high flow nasal cannula or non-invasive ventilation? We use those in a lot of other pulmonary type of patients. How do those fare with asthmatics?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there definitely there's a role for both of those. I would say I lean more towards the side of non-invasive positive pressure ventilation. If you think about the physiology and what you're trying to accomplish, if you can help this patient ventilate, get CO2 out, you're really going to do them some good. The degree to which high flow does that is fairly limited. It does wash out your dead space and gives you a tiny bit of PEEP, usually 2 to 3 centimeters of water if they keep their mouth closed. So you're not really going to get much bang for your buck from the high flow for that. I would use high flow if the patient's decompensating. You don't want to intubate them yet, but they won't tolerate non-invasive. And I would consider non-invasive the first line. For the non-invasive, keep in mind, of course, you do have two main options on the non-invasive side. You have CPAP or continuous positive airway pressure. You also have what we tend to call BiPAP. I actually learned from Haney Malamet years ago that BiPAP is a trade name, so technically we shouldn't use it. We should call it BPAP. But I will tell you, people look at you funny when you say BPAP. But at any rate, BPAP is your bilevel positive airway pressure. And I do tend to favor BPAP, BiPAP, whatever you want to call it, in this instance, because what you're really trying to do is provide some driving pressure to the patient. So if you remember that difference between the top number, your inspiratory pressure, and the bottom number, your expiratory pressure, that's your driving pressure. And your driving pressure is going to be proportional to the patient's tidal volume, and the tidal volume times the respiratory rate is their minute ventilation. And then, of course, the minute ventilation is what's clearing the CO2. So that space between the top number and the bottom number is what's helping the patient clear CO2. The other nice advantage you get from that driving pressure is it's offloading the patient's respiratory muscles, and it's helping prevent them tiring out, or at least giving them a little bit of support so they can go a little bit longer. So especially that patient you have where maybe they're starting to turn the corner, you think they're improving, but let's say they're really tachypneic, they're breathing 35, 40, 45, 50, and you're like, ooh, they're not gonna be able to do this forever, but I think I can get them over this hump. That's a really nice patient to use BiPAP in to try and give them some help with the work of breathing and give them some support while those beta agonists and eventually those steroids and such kick in. As far as non-invasive, the other thing is you do have some PEEP and some positive pressure. So generally, we actually favor a lower PEEP strategy when we're talking about asthma or COPD. And the reason is you can get dynamic hyperinflation. So the lungs are getting larger. You can actually get some decrease in the cardiac preload, which can make these patients unstable. So we tend to favor a lower PEEP, but a little bit of PEEP sometimes can fight off a little bit of atelectasis. It can help a little bit with their VQ matching. So I know it's kind of counterintuitive that you're putting air, kind of forcing air into a patient who's having trouble getting air out. But especially if you're leaning on BiPAP, I think that's a kind of a reasonable way to go.
Yeah, I've had that question in my mind. That was a really great explanation for how BiPAP works. Now, let's say you've tried the BiPAP for a little while, but the patient's still getting worse and it's time to bite the bullet and go forward with intubation. First of all, what are your indications that the patient's going to end up needing to be intubated? What are you looking for in the patient?
Yeah, great question, Amal. Thanks. So first of all, before you reach that point, one thing I did leave out with the BiPAP is easy mistake to make is we talked about that driving pressure. A lot of times we'll see patients are put on, say, 10 over 5 for the BiPAP, and they're getting worse, and someone will come back and reassess them and feel they need to increase their settings. The mistake you don't want to make is going from, say, 10 over 5 to 15 over 10, because again, it's that gap, it's that delta between the numbers that's really helping the patient offload CO2. So first of all, you want to make sure that you've maximized every therapy you have at your availability before intubating the patient. Personally, I consider asthma, obviously you got to do what you need to do. When the patient needs to be intubated, they need to be intubated. But it's one of those conditions where I tend to have a slightly higher threshold for intubating them than some other conditions. And part of that's because they're very challenging, as we'll talk about, I imagine, in a minute, to manage on the ventilator. The obstructive nature of their lung disease makes it very challenging to ventilate them. And it can be dangerous for them sometimes to be on mechanical ventilation. So when you've got to, you've got to. But we do tend to have a slightly higher threshold than some other conditions. I kind of consider status asthmaticus. I keep it in my mind with status epilepticus. That's another condition where usually we certainly intubate them if we have to, but we tend to wait a little longer if we think we can turn the corner. As far as when that corner, you know, can't be turned and when it's time to move down that road, you know, there are no hard and fast rules. This is the bread and butter of emergency medicine. It's really about clinical gestalt. And more than anything, it's about their projected course. So it's not so much about how they're doing right now, but it's about how do you think they're going to do. So the patient who's, say, really, as we alluded to before, really tachypneic, using accessory muscles, but is improving, is maybe their wheezing's getting better. Maybe they were a little hypoxic and that's improving. Clinically, they feel better. They can speak in a few word sentences now. That's a patient that I will continue to try the non-invasive on. On the flip side, that exact same patient in this moment who's maybe getting worse or not improving, maybe you need to go ahead and give yourself a little bit of runway. What you do want to try and avoid, of course, is waiting so late, despite what I said before about having a higher threshold, waiting so late that it's kind of a crash intubation, because then you're really in trouble. If the patient's already obtunded, already floridly hypercarbic, already got a pulse ox in the low 80s or 70s, you really have waited a little too late, and then you got to move awfully fast to secure your airway. So not to mention that even once you get them on the ventilator, turning around some of those problems is going to be a real challenge. So somewhere between those two, I know that's not the best answer in the world, but you know, having that higher threshold, but also not waiting too late.
Classic Goldilocks phenomenon, right? You don't want to intubate too early, but you also don't want to intubate too late. So
if anyone ever figures this out, let me know. It's one of the holy grails of emergency medicine.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, let's say that things you mentioned are happening, worsening tachycardia, hypoxia, Maybe they're getting agitated now also, diaphoretic. It's time to intubate. Take us through that process. And then if you could, talk to us a little bit about what you consider optimal vent settings in your asthma patient who gets intubated.
Yeah, absolutely. So almost hate hearing this or saying this phrase because I work at an academic institution. I like to get procedures for our residents, but this is one where you do want the most experienced intubator and first pass success is really going to matter, especially if some of those later signs are starting to show up. So you want to do everything you can to maximize your first pass success. You want to keep in mind that these patients can decompensate on you in many fashions, right? So we talked before about IV fluids, their risk for hypovolemia. So make sure they're resuscitated beforehand. They could be floridly hypercarbic and acidotic, and that could cause them to have a cardiac collapse during the intubation. They could be hypoxic. So you got to be very careful about doing kind of a quick, skillful, controlled intubation. When you do pass the tube, if you have a choice between multiple endotracheal tubes, a larger endotracheal tube would be ideal. Typically, we say an 8-0 if you can get it in. If that's going to be a problem, if you're having trouble passing the tube, you can't find an 8-0, any of that stuff, do not worry about it. Really, it's not a big deal. If they go upstairs to the ICU, we can swap out the tube later. The reason we say that is twofold, though. One, it'll be easier to manage them on the ventilator with a larger tube because you can get some peak pressure alarms and some things that you just have to kind of tweak the knobs on the ventilator a little bit to deal with if you have a smaller endotracheal tube. The other reason for anyone who hasn't encountered this previously that your intensivist will often ask you for a larger tube is if we have to bronch them a few days later, it gives us better options. So let's say they go up to the ICU and their asthma starts to get better, but they develop a pneumonia or something like that, and I have to bronch them and do a BAL. It's just easier for me. I can use a therapeutic scope and I have more choices, but it's really not a big deal. All you have is 7-0 or something like that. That's fine. Once you've got them on the vent, this is really where the rubber hits the road and where we see patients unfortunately get hurt sometimes. You want to favor lower respiratory rates and you can get away with permissive hypercarbia. And this can be challenging for a few reasons. Patient comes into the ED, we see it with COPD, we see it with asthma. Every few months, I'd say, in the ICU, we get transferred a patient from an outside hospital that has been kind of challengingly managed in this way and can be really, really sick, often because of auto-PEEP. So what happens is the patient comes in. These patients, remember, they're prone to hypercarbia. They're retaining CO2. Asthma, not as bad as COPD, but both of them can. And let's say you do get that blood gas and you find a pH of 6.8 or 6.7 and a PCO2 that's kind of off the charts. It can be easy once you've got them intubated to pay very close attention and to be really worried about that pH, which to some degree you should be, and as a result, to increase the respiratory rate. What we've done, for better or for worse, in critical care over the last decade or two is we have really rammed into people's heads that we want low tidal volumes. And we talk a lot about the ARMA trial and ARDS and 6 to 8 cc's per kilo. And so when people are battling hypercarbia nowadays, often they will not increase the tidal volume, which is very reasonable. We like that, but they will increase the respiratory rate. But you have to be careful with these patients with asthma because they are air trapping. They are probably already having dynamic hyperinflation, some degree of auto-PEEP. And so if you put them on high respiratory rates, it can be very dangerous for them. It's really important for the emergency provider to know what auto-PEEP looks like on a ventilator. Unfortunately, on podcasts, I can't draw it out for you, so my apologies. But if you just Google auto-PEEP on ventilator, you'll see some waveforms. What you're looking for is that there are actually several signs of auto-PEEP on a ventilator, but the main one that we pay attention to is that flow waveform will go down into the expiratory phase. You'll see a large exhalation, and it will exponentially start to head back towards that zero line. If the next breath comes before you get to that zero line, you should be concerned that there's auto-PEEP going on. If you're worried about auto-PEEP, there's a maneuver you can do. If you're not comfortable with this or haven't done it before, just grab your respiratory therapist. They can help you out. It's just called an expiratory hold. And what you do is you hold down a button on the ventilator. And what it will do is at the end of exhalation, it will actually lock all the valves and measure the actual PEEP in the patient, the intrinsic PEEP. So you can actually check that if you're concerned about it. But the real thing you want to do, now that said, if the pH is 6.6, 6.5, 6.4, especially if the patient's getting unstable, let's say they're on escalating doses of pressors, things like that. Yeah, that hypercarbia and that acidosis is a problem for you. So you got to balance that. I'm not saying it's okay for patients to be just wildly acidotic. Up in the ICU, we tend to target 7.2 or higher. And honestly, even in the 7.1s, even in the 7.0s, if the patient's really hemodynamically very stable, I'm okay with that as long as I'm making sure that they're not auto-PEEPing.
Great. I was writing down, how low are you willing to go with the pH? And you answered that with the last thing. How low have you allowed the pH to drop in the past without really saying, you know what, we need to do something about this? What's the lowest you've let it ride?
Yeah, I mean, the answer to that would be 6.8, 6.9. The crux point there is really hemodynamic instability in my mind, or other signs of end organ dysfunction. The main thing you worry about is if they're on, say, norepinephrine and you're going up and up on your dose and it doesn't seem to be doing anything, that's a classic tip of the hat to us in the ICU for acidosis. That's a very common condition that will cause pressors to be ineffective. Obviously, it'll cause other end organ dysfunction for the patient. But if they're rock solid, stable, not on any pressors, have a totally normal blood pressure, and they are right up against their auto-PEEP, if I increase their respiratory rate at all, they would auto-PEEP. I would tolerate 6.8, 6.9. The caveat I would give to that is if they're trending in the right direction. If they're going from 6.8, 6.9 down to 6.7, 6.6, different story. And even if they're staying at 6.8, 6.9, I'd be very nervous about that. And by the way, there's no hard and fast literature to support, just for the listeners, what I'm describing here, this kind of anecdotal experience. But if they're rock solid stable, you have to be okay with more acidosis than most people are typically okay with. The other thing I would say in that situation is there are things you can tweak on the ventilator other than the respiratory rate to try and get a little bit of bang for your buck. The main thing would be increasing your inspiratory flow rate, or depending on your ventilator, decreasing your inspiratory time. And that what that will do is buy you a little bit more expiratory time. It doesn't have a huge effect, but if you're in that scenario where you really can't increase the respiratory rate and you're battling just a terrible acidosis, you want to make sure you've maximized everything you can do. The other thing you can think about is, you know, further sedation and paralytics. And sometimes in that situation, I will go ahead and just push rocuronium or start a sesamectin drip and just take the patient out of the equation.
The authors also mentioned ECLS, or extracorporeal life support, which I have to admit, I've never had or seen a patient with bad asthma in the emergency department who got intubated and then ended up having to go for extracorporeal life support, at least from the emergency department. Is that something you've seen from the ICU? And also, is there good evidence for that?
Yeah, I've managed a couple of patients on ECMO for asthma. The nice thing about when we talk about ECMO and asthma is you have, right, keep in mind that ECMO, of course, is a spectrum. So when we talk about ECLS specifically, that's one end of the spectrum. So that'd be your patients in cardiac arrest. If you encounter, and most of us know from experience, often these asthmatics you're managing in the ED are younger, relatively healthy beyond their asthma folks. If you know, have a patient who's really, really sick from an asthma exacerbation, goes into Florida cardiac arrest, if you catch them early in the arrest, their underlying physiology is pretty good, they're in pretty decent health, I definitely would consider activating your ECLS if you have that as a resource, and considering crashing them onto VA ECMO. Beyond that, on the other end of the spectrum, right, you have standard non-arrest VA ECMO, and then you have VV ECMO. Because asthma is primarily a pulmonary issue, VV ECMO is not an unreasonable consideration for patients who are really sick with asthma. The main thing I would say for any ECMO consult that our consultants, I'm not an ECMO specialist, but our ECMO consultants frequently relay to us, is make sure you call early. So obviously not like, hey, I gave them one neb, they're totally fine, they're on 2 liters nasal cannula. They probably won't appreciate that. But you know, make sure that you're not waiting till patients are in Florida rest if you can get them earlier, because there is some data that things like VV ECMO are reasonable considerations. What they'll do is they'll rest the lungs, they'll put the patient on minimal vent settings, and then the ECMO circuit will actually take care of that clearance of CO2 and that oxygenation for them. And it will help kind of rest the lungs if they think there's a reversible cause. And of course, asthma exacerbations are certainly on that list when we talk about ECMO and reversible causes. So it's definitely worth considering.
Well, Mark, that was a really great review of this article. How about if you could close things out with what you would say are, say, the top three pitfalls you've seen as an ICU attending in the management of critically ill patients with asthma who are initially managed in the emergency department?
Yeah, thanks, Amal. So I think the main take-home points I would leave the folks with are, number one, make sure you know your algorithm and your initial therapies, right? This is bread and butter emergency medicine. I think most folks are familiar with this. Just like anything, as you get further down the algorithm, you may be less comfortable with it. When we talk about things like Heliox or ketamine, ECMO, it may not be something you're doing regularly, but I think having an algorithmic approach is really useful. And again, obviously starting with your first lines, your beta agonists, your antimuscarinics, your steroids. We actually didn't talk about magnesium. That's a little bit of an oversight here, but that is a part of the algorithm. They give it in this, the algorithm in this article as well. And that definitely should be a consideration. Usually I'll pull the trigger on mag around the time I'm thinking about non-invasive or high flow. It's not unreasonable. A lot of people in their practice pattern use mag first line right up there with the beta agonist. That's not unreasonable as well. But whatever your algorithm is, as long as you have kind of a systematic approach, you walk through the first line, then the second line, then the third line. I think that it's a good idea to have a systematic approach to these patients. The second pitfall I would leave you with is not reassessing your patients frequently enough. So these patients can, as you mentioned at the top, often they do well, especially the less severe asthma exacerbations. We can get them home. I agree with you. It's a very satisfying condition to take care of. They feel great. We feel great. But they can also crump on you very quickly. So that's where objective measures, if you have them, are very useful. If the patient will tolerate a peak flow, that's helpful. I know we kind of disparaged ABGs and VBGs before, and I think appropriately so to some degree, but that's also a nice objective measure if you have one. Pulse ox, looking at the end tidal waveform, things like this, in addition to what is most important, which is how the patient feels and how they look clinically, making sure you're circling back to the room regularly and taking a look at them. And then the third and I would say biggest pitfall I would give you is if you're going to intubate and you've got them on the ventilator, make sure as best you can, you're following what we call an obstructive strategy, where you can tolerate permissive hypercapnia, favor a lower respiratory rate, closely look at the ventilator for signs of auto PEEP. Of course, if they're getting hemodynamically unstable, you may be stuck between a rock and a hard place with your hypercarbia and your respiratory rate. But as best you can, you want to make sure that you're not doing anything to cause dynamic hyperinflation and auto PEEP.
That was fantastic, Mark. Thanks so much for your time and taking us through this article and adding all of your own personal experience with this. These definitely are common patients. The sickest ones are not, but like you said, when they go down, they can go down really fast. And these are patients that can be very scary. And worst of all, oftentimes these are relatively young patients that really don't have terminal illness. And so these are just the absolute awful patients to end up losing. So these are some really great pearls you've given us. So again, thanks so much. And I'm going to be calling you for a few more of these EM casts. So keep your phone lines open.
Please do. Thanks so much, Amal. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark.
Okay, well, our next discussion is actually going to be a recorded lecture from our recent Crashing Patient Conference this past fall. That conference is largely focused on risk management topics, and that's exactly what our next discussant is going to spend some time talking about. And she's actually somebody who's been on the EMcast before, discussing various other high-risk type of topics. Dr. Priya Kupusamy, who finished our residency a handful of years ago. She then did a teaching and faculty development fellowship. She's been working out in the community in a very busy emergency department near D.C. And recently, she's actually set up a risk management fellowship as well as elective for our residents and graduates of our residency. And she's really beginning to focus her career more and more on risk management. And she's going to be talking about a very bread and butter topic that we all face almost every day, perhaps some days even more than once a day. It's a high risk topic that has to do with informed refusal of care and against medical advice discharges. And this is a topic that is a high risk for litigation and for disasters that can occur. So with that, I'm going to hand things over to Priya. And she may have some slides that she refers to, but I think for the most part, everything is very obvious from the audio that you are going to be hearing. So Priya, go ahead and take it away.
I am super excited to be here today to talk to you about a risk management topic. So I'll be talking about AMA disasters. So let's just go ahead and get started. So I don't have any financial disclosures, but I do have two disclaimers. The first disclaimer is I don't want risk management to scare you. I want it to empower you. I want it to empower you to get the knowledge, the tools, so you have a leg to stand on if something goes wrong. And guess what? Something probably will go wrong because we're in emergency medicine. It's a highly litigious specialty, but I don't want that to make you scared. I want you to be empowered. The second disclaimer that I have is I cannot be standing up here talking at the Crashing Patient Conference and not mention, not acknowledge all of the crashing ED clinicians and nurses and techs and unit clerks, environmental services, and everyone working day in and day out, trying to just do their best and stay afloat. We are all in this together. We are tired, we are exhausted, but we're going to get through it together. So let's go ahead and get started. What do I want you to get out of my presentation today? I'm going to talk about capacity, and we'll talk about how to determine it. I'll also identify some of the key elements that's important in an AMA process, and then we'll talk about some AMA pearls and pitfalls. First, I'm going to give you a couple of cases just to get you thinking in the risk management mode. Case number one is a 39-year-old French-speaking male who pulls into your emergency department with altered mental status. You quickly realize he's intoxicated when the alcohol level comes back at 395.
And those units, by the way, are in milligrams per deciliter. And to put things in context for those people that may not be using those same units, generally, the legal driving limit is around 80. And interestingly, I had to look this up, the units. And in the chapter that I was looking it up in, it actually said that patients are at risk for dying once their alcohol level gets above 300 to 400. Frankly, we see patients walking around on a good day with alcohol levels at around 300 or so. So it's interesting. I don't know who the people are that write the chapters. But anyway, milligrams per deciliter. Priya, back to you.
You go see some other patients, so you're in a totally different room. And an hour later, the patient says, I feel fine. I'm going to leave. The nurse can't find you. You're in with another patient, and this patient is trying to leave. So she hands him an AMA paper and says, here, sign this. The patient signs it and walks out the door. I want you to tell me, what is your initial reaction? And I'll give you some choices. Is it peace out, bye-bye? Is it, oh, so glad you signed that AMA form? Or is it, I don't know, I feel a little nervous? Go ahead and lock in your answers. Let's see what you guys think. What is your initial gut reaction?
And Priya was using Poll Everywhere to get responses from the audience off live stream. Let's see what they were thinking.
All right. Well, it looks like we have a unanimous, maybe not. Spoke too soon. Looks like a lot of people are feeling nervous. All right, let's move on to the next case. So case number two is an 85-year-old grandma. She's got history of dementia, and she comes in to your shop, febrile. She's tachycardic, and she's got a pretty bad pneumonia, probably septic too. You recommend admission to the doc, to the daughter, but the daughter says, nah, I'm taking her home. She'll be fine. The daughter also says, and I'm not going to sign that AMA form. My mom can sign it. She's fine. So what do you do in this situation? I'll give you some choices. Are you going to have grandma sign the AMA form? Are you going to run after the daughter for the signature? Or option three, are you going to pull an Elsa and let it go? So go ahead. Tell me what you guys are thinking. Seeing some answers pop up. So it looks like the majority of people want to run after the daughter for the signature. Nobody's really picking let it go. Oh, some are. And we'll go back to these cases later on in the talk. Let's go to case number three. So you've got a 66-year-old female, history of everything. I mean everything. Hypertension, diabetes, hyperlipidemia, CAD, CHF, cabbage, lettuce, potatoes, you name it. She's got everything. And she comes in with this crushing substernal chest pain that radiates down the left arm, and it's associated with nausea, vomiting, diaphoresis. She's got an ugly-looking EKG, but it's not a STEMI, and her first trope is negative. You're thinking, this is a slam-dunk admission. Let me get this done so I can move on to my other patients. Except the patient says, mm-mm, I'm not staying. I'm going home. And you're like, come on, I got to move on to my other patients. And she's not budging. She's not going to stay. So you get frustrated. You've already spent 15 minutes in this room trying to convince her to stay. So out of exasperation, you say, well, if you leave, insurance won't pay. What do you guys think of that statement? I'll give you some choices. Does that statement sound about right? Is it not true? Or have you heard that line before, but you're not sure? What do you guys think? So far, and I don't want to speak ahead of myself, but so far it looks like it's not true is winning. So let's talk about AMA, all things AMA. In the U.S., 1 to 3% of patients leave against medical advice. So that's about 500,000 patients per year. It's a lot. Patients who leave AMA, they tend to have higher risk of repeat ED visits, higher rates of admission, and higher 30-day mortality. But we know that patients can leave at any time they choose for any reason. They are allowed to leave if they have capacity. We may not always agree with why they're leaving or the fact that they're leaving, but we have to respect their decision if they want to leave. For all of those reasons that I mentioned, with the admission rates, the repeat ED visits, we should take a vested interest in preventing these patients from leaving against medical care. But ultimately, if they have capacity, they can leave. So let's talk about capacity. Capacity is the cornerstone of AMA. I want to first start with capacity versus competency, because these terms are often used interchangeably in the EM literature. With competency, I want you to think of it as lawyer talk. It involves a judge, it involves court, it involves hearing. It doesn't really apply to the emergency department setting. Capacity, however, is in our lane. We can determine capacity. It's a patient's ability to make decisions. It's basically an assessment of a patient's clinical status. We, as ED clinicians, can determine capacity, and we should. Capacity is decision specific. What do I mean by that? It's decision specific. Let's say you've got a patient who comes into the emergency department who's actively suicidal with a plan. Like, if you leave her out of your sight, if you let her out of your sight, she's going to hurt herself. She's super high risk. So she becomes involuntary as the psychiatry team is looking for a bed. Even though she's involuntary, as long as she has capacity, she can still refuse other things. She can refuse a blood draw. She can also refuse a COVID test. So just because she's involuntary from one standpoint doesn't mean she's given up all of her rights. Capacity is also dynamic specific. It's a dynamic status. What do I mean by that? So let's say someone comes into your emergency department with altered mental status or they're hypoxic and they don't have capacity on your initial evaluation. Let's say they're intoxicated. But then time goes by and their condition improves and maybe even reverses. So then this patient with reevaluation may actually gain capacity back and be able to make their own decisions. So capacity is decision specific and it's dynamic. Keep that in mind. So now that we know that we can determine capacity, how do we go about determining it? And there are four key steps I want you to think about. Now, this doesn't have to be a long, drawn-out process. You can gather all of this information by just sitting there with your patient and having a normal conversation. I want you to think about if the patient can understand the information that you're presenting to them and if they can apply that information to the decision that they're trying to make. Can they use sound reasoning? Are they rational? Are they using judgment, good or bad? Are they using judgment? And are they able to express their choice to you in a clear manner? These are the questions to ask yourself. Let's go deeper into the AMA process. When we think of AMA, we typically think of the form, right? The AMA form, the thing that the patient signs before they walk out the door and ride on into the sunset. But the AMA form is actually just the tip of a much larger iceberg. The larger iceberg is the whole AMA process. And like I just mentioned, the AMA form is just the tip of it. I want you to focus on the process because the process is what's going to be more important than the paper. So here I am talking about process and paper and process is more important. Well, now I want to give you some type of structure to the AMA process so you can use that to develop your own custom and practice and become consistent in this so you don't miss anything. I came across a great article by Clark and others where they basically outline the key elements that's necessary for a strong AMA encounter. And they came up with this mnemonic, AIMED. I love mnemonics, but I cannot take credit for that one. They came up with this one, and it's AIMED. A is for assess, I for investigate, M for mitigate, E for explain, and D for document. Let's go through these different elements. So A is for assess. Assess the severity of the illness. How bad is it? And how time sensitive is it? How much time do you have before you think the patient may deteriorate? You want to assess capacity, which we've already talked about, and you want to identify barriers and potentially identify them before you sit down and talk to the patient about the AMA and decisions they need to make so that you can potentially address it. So barriers come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. A common barrier is language. And one of the pitfalls, traps that I want you to pay attention to is those situations where a patient doesn't speak English, they have another language that they prefer, and you understand some of that language, but you're not 100% fluent. So initially, when you're trying to figure out where their abdominal pain is, does it radiate, how severe is it on a scale of 1 to 10, you can get by. You can wing it because you've got some knowledge of the language. But when you have to go through the AMA process with this patient, I want you to get an interpreter. And that's because there's a lot of technical terms that may come up. You want to make sure your patient understands you, and then you want to make sure that you're understood by the patient and you can actually answer their questions so they feel comfortable enough to answer it. And you also have to be able to determine if the patient has capacity. And if you're not understanding what they're saying, you could think they don't have capacity when in fact they do. Now, how can you get into trouble with this? Well, let's say you go through the whole encounter without an interpreter and you're not 100% fluent in the language. The patient later on can say, hey, I didn't understand anything the physician said. And you're back to square one. They can say, oh, there was no interpreter. What leg do you have to fall on? The other way that it can get you in trouble is that plaintiff attorneys are going to love to put you on the spot and test your fluency and try to prove that you are not 100% fluent. And when they prove that, guess what? That entire AMA encounter, the process, the paper, everything becomes null and void. Beware of that trap. So the I is for investigate. You want to look into the patient's reasons for leaving. Do they want to leave because they have a diabetic cat that needs insulin? Do they want to leave because they have little children at home and childcare is an issue? Or do they want to leave because they're just scared? And maybe if you answer some of their questions and allay their fears, that's all they needed to be convinced to stay. You want to also get help from family and the primary doctor if the patient allows you to speak with them. Family can be helpful. Maybe the patient has an Aunt Jane, and Aunt Jane, she listens to everything Aunt Jane says. So when Aunt Jane says, you got to stay, you're not coming home, the doctor told you to stay, that might be all the patient needed to say, okay, I'm staying. The second reason with regards to family is, listen, if something bad happens to this patient, the family is the one who's going to be suing you. So you might as well get them on board with the AMA process and explain the risks. Primary doctors can be helpful too. Primary doctors may have an established rapport and relationship with the patient. The patient may actually trust their primary doctor more than they trust you because they just met you. So try to see if you can get a hold of the primary doctor in those situations. They can come in pretty handy. So you want to try to convince your patient to stay, but you also don't want to tell them incorrect statements like, oh, insurance won't pay if you leave AMA. But it's wrong. Don't use that line. Case three, remember the 66-year-old female who has history of everything? She's got a hard score of like 50,000, and she definitely needs to stay, but she doesn't want to stay. Well, no matter what, you can use a lot of tactics to try to convince her, but don't use incorrect statements. It's just not right. M is for mitigate. You want to mitigate the risk as much as you can and as much as the patient will allow. So what do I mean by that? You want to offer the maximal treatment acceptable to the patient. So go down that treatment pathway as far as you can until the patient says, that's it, nothing else. So let's go back to that 66-year-old patient presenting with chest pain. Maybe she doesn't want to be admitted, but maybe you could convince her to stay for one more troponin. Maybe you can convince her to take an aspirin. You want to also provide discharge instructions and return precautions just like you would for any other discharge. Don't treat AMA patients differently and not give them anything. You also want to give them parting gifts like any necessary prescriptions. Patient with pneumonia. Okay, she's got pneumonia and she doesn't want to stay. Well, at least give prescriptions for antibiotics. But let the patient know that this doesn't mean you're changing your recommendation. All of a sudden you're like, okay, I suppose it's fine. You can go home. You're okay. You still recommend admission, but something is better than nothing. If you can't stay for the IV antibiotics, here are some oral antibiotics that you can take. And tell the patient that this is a temporizing measure only. It's likely not going to fix it. And with regards to parting gifts and prescriptions, don't prescribe any medications that may mask symptoms that would otherwise prevent the patient from coming back to your emergency department if something worsens. You also want to stay clear of negative connotations, negative terms, saying things like taking a my way or the highway stance. Stay clear of those things because that's probably going to push the patient away, and they're definitely not going to want to come back to the emergency department if something gets worse. If a patient leaves before signing that AMA form or they refuse to sign, take a non-adversarial approach. It's just a piece of paper. What have we learned so far? The process is more important than the paper. If you've sat down and you've gone through the AMA process with the patient, you've got extra nurses to witness that you talk to them. Okay, patient doesn't want to sign, or patient leaves before you get the signature. All right, document you did the AMA process because that's going to be more important than the piece of paper. E is for explain. Explain the risks, explain the benefits, the alternatives, explain the dangers of failing to follow the plan. And most importantly, tell the patient you can return at any time if you change your mind. If you leave and walk out these doors, and 5 seconds later, you change your mind, you tell them they can come back and there's no hard feelings. We're happy to take care of you. What if you've tried to convince the patient, you've tried everything, and they are just not buying it? What can you do? You've got to do your best to try to convince the patient that you are trying to do things for their best interest. You are acting on their best interest. Maybe you can try to figure out what are their reasons? What is their hang-up that's keeping them from following your recommendation? Try to explain yourself so they see your point of view as well. You want to use compassionate statements. What do I mean by that? Say, if you were my family member, this is what I would say. This is what I would do. You can also say things like, look, it would be easy to have you sign a piece of paper and you go on your way against medical advice, but that's not the right thing. I want to sit with you to figure out why you don't want to answer your questions and try to convince you to stay. That's going to take longer, but that's why I'm here as your physician, as your clinician. While you want to use compassionate statements, you also don't want to shy away from words like death, words like die and cancer, permanent disability, sexual dysfunction. That one usually gets people's attention. You want to use those words. Why? You don't want to sugarcoat anything. You want your patient to know the risks, right? You want to paint a clear picture of what could happen if they leave your department. And then D. D is for document. D is the last part of AIMED. You want to document, document, document. You want to do and say what you document, and you want to document what you do and say. Remember, AMA is a labor-intensive process. Don't you want to get credit for all that time and energy spent in the patient's room talking to them about this stuff? So make sure you document. And you also want to make it very clear in the chart that you went through the AMA process. Because if you don't put it in the chart, then how will people know you did that? All that time and energy. So document, make it very clear in the chart that you went through the AMA process, not just have them sign the form, that you went the extra mile to convince this patient to stay. What I don't want you to do, just don't do it, I don't want you to write in the chart, patient prefers discharge. Why is that? Most patients want to go home and sleep in their own bed. Most patients don't want the turkey sandwich. They want to go home. So they're looking to you as the expert. They're looking to you for the expert advice. So don't put that in the chart. It's up to you to give them the recommendations. I mentioned before that AMA process is labor intensive. It's also a setup for disaster with no winner. So it's not just about signing a piece of paper. It's more about the process than the paper. So some incapacitated, altered patients will sign about anything you put in front of them. Other patients will refuse to sign anything. So you can't just rely on the piece of paper. You've got to rely on the process. AMA forms, they're not completely useless. They do serve a purpose, and they do play a part in the larger iceberg of the AMA process. There's nothing magical about a form that's going to give you a get-out-of-jail-free card. You can still get sued, and you can still lose, even though a patient signs out against medical advice. What's going to give you and your lawyer a leg to stand on is excellent communication with your patient and a thorough documentation put together. That's what's going to give you the best success in an AMA encounter. So, patients do not waive the right to litigate for any injuries that may occur. And you might be thinking, oh, but on my AMA form, it says, by signing this, I can't sue anybody. Not true. Plaintiff attorneys can quickly take that over to the court and they can overturn it. So don't rely on that. Practice the process. You also want to steer clear of that good riddance attitude, even though it feels so good in the moment. It feels so good in the moment, right? It's like, okay, goodbye, see ya, peace out. You want to steer clear of that because of what I just mentioned. You can still get sued, you can still lose. So remember case number two, 85-year-old grandma, got a pneumonia, probably septic, and the daughter said, nope, not going to sign the form. My mom can sign it. What do we learn? We learned it's okay. We learned we got to let it go. Because as long as we sat with the daughter and went through the AMA process, and we got our witnesses, and we documented all of it, it's okay if she didn't sign, because we did all of the work. I want you to also use the AMA form to your advantage. You can use it for other things. Even though a patient doesn't necessarily leave against medical advice, they can also refuse any part of the ED course and evaluation. They can refuse a pelvic exam, a rectal exam. They can refuse lab work, CAT scans. So what I want you to use this form is go through that AMA process when they're refusing something that you think is important for the workup, GI bleed, rectal exam. Oh, no, can't do it. Sorry. Go through the AMA process and then have them sign the AMA form. This form has a section that says refusing the following recommended care, treatment, testing. If your form doesn't have that section, that's okay. Just write it in and make sure you document. But most importantly, go through the same process with them, even if they're not leaving against medical advice. Can nurses sign a patient out AMA? Yes, they technically can. They can hand a patient a piece of paper and say, sign here. But what's missing? The process. You need a clinician to assess capacity, talk to them about risks and benefits, and do all of that. A signature on a paper is not going to hold any weight without all that other stuff before. And patients who come in altered, lacking capacity, but feel better, need a clinician reevaluation before you consider them for discharge or AMA. So, going back to case number one, the 39-year-old patient who presented intoxicated and then an hour later said, I feel better, I'm leaving. The nurse couldn't find the physician, so she handed him an AMA form, which he signed. An hour later, he comes back to your shop as a trauma arrest because he got hit by a bus. And you might be thinking, but I have the form. Look, he signed the form, which is great, but nobody talked to him. The clinician didn't talk to him about the risks, the benefits. They didn't even assess to see if he had capacity. So what good is that form? It's not going to hold up in court. So the process is more important than the form. Let's take it home. Don't forget about AIMED. Make this your consistent practice. Make it your consistent practice on your next shift. Assess, investigate, mitigate, explain, and document. Make sure you look into capacity for every patient you see. It's often quick. Sometimes it takes longer, but you as the ED clinician can determine capacity and should determine it. Remember, insurance companies can still pay for AMA discharges. Patients who leave AMA can still sue you, and you can still lose. And patients with altered mental status need a clinician reevaluation prior to leaving against medical advice. And most importantly, if I haven't mentioned this enough, I'm not sure, the process is more important than the form. AMA forms are not a substitute for good communication and documentation.
All right. Well, my thanks to Dr. Kupasamy for a great discussion of such an important talk. And now let's go ahead and change gears once again. All right. Well, next up on EMCast, we're going to do a little pediatrics. We haven't really done enough pediatrics, I think, and it's been a while since we did any really good topics about sick kids. Well, recently in Annals of Emergency Medicine, they published a very nice review article, and they don't do review articles too often in Annals of Emergency Medicine. So when they do, it always catches my attention. And this one was on managing diabetic ketoacidosis in kids. And the first author, I'm sure I'm going to get this name wrong, but I'll do my best. The first author is Leah Ziminatos, and the second author is Lise Nigrovich. I hope I'm getting those names right, and if I messed them up, I apologize. But it was a really, really nice article on a topic that I think gets many of us very anxious. I think, in general, we in emergency medicine are fairly comfortable managing diabetic ketoacidosis. In fact, we oftentimes look forward to it because these are sick patients, and we really have a good handle on what to do with them. But actually, when it comes to kids, we tend to be a little bit more anxious about this. And so this article really, really addressed something I think that we all need to learn about. And joining me to go through this article and discuss some of the key points is one of the junior members of the team, Dr. Spencer Lovegrove. Spencer is an outstanding clinician, and I'm sure that in the coming years, you're going to be hearing a lot more from him, hopefully on EMCast, but also in academic circles in the coming years as well. So Spencer, first of all, welcome to EMed Home's EMCast. Great to have you here.
Oh, thanks for having me. I look forward to talking on this topic. It's good timing. We're right around the holidays recording this, and I'm sure I'm going to go eat some Christmas cookies afterwards. So.
that's true. I'm sure we're going to be getting a lot of people with the sweet tooth right around New Year's as well. Well, Spencer, as I mentioned, I think most of us in EM are pretty comfortable caring for adult patients with DK, but PEDS DK is definitely a more anxiety-provoking condition. So let's go through this article step by step. So first of all, they talk about the signs and symptoms that should really tip us off to DKA diagnosis in kids. Can you take us through that section?
Yeah. So, I mean, when people come in with DKA and kids too, they come in with a spectrum typically. You'll have people just complaining of some nausea, some abdominal discomfort, all the way up to altered mental status with that hallmark tachypnea, Kussmaul respirations that we like to describe, and the acetone smelling breath that I don't know that I've ever smelled. And certainly with our new N95s because of COVID have not been able to smell, but you can have that. And then additionally, it is important to know that approximately 30% of kids, when they have their first diagnosis of diabetes, they're going to come in DKA. So you may get a history from parents that they have had some long times of polyuria, polydipsia, some weight loss, some fatigue, just not acting themselves. So in those kids, you might just get a history that for a few months, they just have not been as playful as normal. They've been peeing a lot, drinking a bunch, and that should tip you off that maybe we're dealing with a pediatric DKA case here.
Pearls, I didn't realize that 30% of patients will, I guess, show up with DKA as their initial manifestation of diabetes. And that's kind of scary because a lot of these patients obviously are going to show up with no prior known medical history of diabetes, and you've got to make that diagnosis. So it's a really nice pearl. And I totally agree with you about the N95s and how the classic smells of emergency medicine are missing, for better or worse. Now, what about the lab tests? Are there specific lab tests that we should be ordering and also expect to find abnormalities in patients with DKA?
Yeah, so typically if you're concerned about DKA because of the findings we discussed before, you would start with the point of care glucose test. You get that finger stick. And typically you'd expect it to be greater than 200 if you're dealing with DKA. Additionally, once you've gone down that route, you'd want to go ahead and check their VBG or an ABG to see what their pH is. Typically, you'd expect it to be less than 7.3. And then you want to check for ketones somehow, either through their urine, you'd expect it to be moderate or large, or you can get a beta hydroxybutyrate level if you're going to just do it off of the serum. You'd also, along with those tests, want to go ahead and send a full chemistry panel that would allow you to check their potassium as well as their renal function. These patients may have an AKI from dehydration. Remember, they've been having polydipsia and polyuria for potentially quite some time at this point, as well as, like I said, you want to get a VBG, a UA to check for ketones as well as infection. Maybe a urinary tract infection is kind of the insult that is causing them to have DKA. And then you can also go ahead and send the hemoglobin A1C. That's not going to be particularly helpful in the emergency department setting, but in the inpatient setting, particularly with the new onset DKA, your colleagues will thank you for that. And then this is not a lab test, but I do like to get EKGs on pretty much all of my DKA patients. I believe the article mentioned that you should get one if you do see that there is an electrolyte abnormality like potassium. I like to go ahead and get it up front. I don't, you know, the potassium sometimes takes quite a while to come back from the lab. And I'd rather than sit around and wait for that to come back, have an idea if there's a severe electrolyte abnormality that's causing EKG abnormalities earlier. And also, particularly more so in adults, there is some concern that potentially the insult causing your DKA could be due to cardiac ischemia, and you would hate to miss that. I personally have had at least one adult case where a patient came in with altered mental status and vomiting, no complaint of chest pain, and it turned out that they were having a STEMI. So sometimes diabetics present abnormally with cardiac ischemia, and so I just get an EKG on everybody.
Love that thought. You know I do. All right. So broad spectrum labs and a screen for infection, EKG, the ABG or VBG all sounds pretty straightforward. And also the hemoglobin A1C for your inpatient colleague sounds great. All right. Now let's switch over and talk about treatment. And that's where I feel like things kind of get tricky, especially the fluid recommendations. You know, with adults, we know that these patients are always very dehydrated. So we can just hang some fluids and open it up and run in a lot of fluids. But at least where I trained, it seemed like the fluid recommendations were really complicated. And everything from there on out made the fluid recommendations just made everything else more complicated. So what do these authors say about fluid recommendations?
Yeah, so you want to go ahead and start out with initial 10 cc per kilogram bolus for pretty much every patient that comes in DKA. That'll help with your hyperglycemia and then their volume status as well. And then after that, you can base your further fluid resuscitation off of their volume status. So if you think they need more, then you can give more. And if you don't think they need more, then you can convert to doing what's called the two-bag system. Now, I think this is probably where people get tripped up, particularly in pediatrics. I know in our adult emergency department, we don't use the two-bag system, whereas in the pediatrics department, we do. So basically, the two-bag system is designed to allow you to give the patient maintenance to 1.5 time maintenance. And you have one bag with dextrose in it, so it's like 10% D10. And then you have another that is just potentially just normal saline. And depending on what your blood sugar is, you will give more or less of that dextrose containing solution to allow you to keep an appropriate glucose level while you're treating them. Now, where this gets an extra level of complicated is when you check that patient's initial potassium, depending on what that level is, you may need to go ahead and start treating them with potassium. So between 3.5 to 5.5 or so in that range, you're going to want to go ahead and have your fluids to have potassium included in them. So instead of ordering one bag of normal saline and one bag of D10, you're going to order one bag of normal saline containing potassium and one bag of D10 containing potassium. That way, when you're giving the solution, you can also be repleting their potassium in addition to their fluid status and their dextrose. Now, I know in our department, we have a table that will basically tell you starting at a glucose of 300, you want to give X amount of D10 and X amount of normal saline. And then it will continue to increase the amount of D10 as that glucose drops further. There are some times where the D10 is not going to cut it, and you're going to need to make that second bag something higher, like a D12.5. We've done that before, just to make sure that you're keeping that patient with a safe glucose level while you're treating them.
That helps somewhat. Besides potassium, are there any other electrolytes that we need to really keep track of and replace as diligently as potassium?
Potassium's the big one. Remember that when we're giving our insulin, we're going to be driving the patient's potassium from their serum into their cells. And that these patients overall, their total body potassium levels are likely low, even if the serum potassium at the time you first check it is elevated. So we're going to need to stay on top of the potassium first and foremost. Like I said, below a potassium of 3.5, you are going to need to wait to start your insulin. And then between 3.5 and 5.5, you can go ahead and start your insulin in conjunction with your potassium containing fluids. And then above 5.5, you can just go ahead and start your insulin. As far as other electrolytes, to get back to your question, whenever we replace potassium, typically we like to stay on top of the magnesium. And then all of these patients can have a multitude of other electrolyte abnormalities. You may notice that they have hyponatremia, but remember in these patients, it's likely pseudohyponatremia, and that if you correct for the amount of glucose in their serum, that they probably have about a normal sodium level. You may also notice calcium, phosphate abnormalities, but again, potassium I think is probably the big one, and then you may need to replace magnesium at the same time to make your potassium replacement worthwhile.
All right, very good. You mentioned starting the insulin, and obviously we need to be careful about the insulin because it can rapidly shift the potassium. But in terms of the initiation of insulin, when and how do we initiate the insulin? Like there's always this controversy about, do you bolus the insulin? What dose do you start it with on the drip? And so take us through that.
Yeah. So to make it clear on when it is safe to start insulin in these patients, you know, we do want to get that initial potassium level back first. So our initial treatment, like we said before, is going to be that 10 cc per kg bolus of just normal saline. And after that, hopefully our first potassium level is back. And if we see that that potassium is above a level of 3.5, then we feel pretty good about going ahead and starting insulin. Now between 3.5, and I've always been taught 5.5, we do want to start potassium at the same time as the insulin. The article mentions 5. So I think, you know, anywhere between that 5.5 and 5 range is probably your upper limit of where you want to go ahead and start potassium at the same time as your insulin. And above 5.5, you can go ahead and just start the insulin. You don't need to replace potassium. As far as the how do we initiate insulin question, it's typically at a rate of 0.1 units per kilogram per hour. Historically, some people would say that you should bolus these patients first, But I think more recent data is showing that really you just need to make sure that the insulin is nice and primed through your IV line. And that way that when you're actually starting the insulin is starting to infuse into the patient's serum and you're not waiting a long time for the insulin to run through your IV tubing. There's not really a need for a bolus.
That does help clarify things. In terms of priming the line, what exactly does that mean?
Typically is just that you need to have the insulin go through the entirety of your IV tubing in addition to the J loop so that when you hit start on the pump, insulin pump, that the insulin is starting to go through the patient's veins and you're not just waiting for it to move through the IV tubing and the J loop while you're waiting, while the pump is going.
Got it. And then how frequently are you reassessing the electrolytes and the glucose levels of these patients?
Typically, we're sending doing a point of care glucose every hour while they're on the insulin infusion. And then we're checking a chemistry panel as well as a VBG every 2 hours to check in on our anion gap, as well as our pH and our bicarb level. So these patients are getting pretty frequent labs and hourly finger sticks.
Given all the backlog and delays in the emergency department, this is becoming more important for us to know in the emergency department. Before, these patients used to just fly right upstairs to the pediatric ICU, but I think peds ICUs are quite backed up also. So these frequent finger sticks and electrolytes definitely are something for all of us to know. Now, Spencer, if a child's really sick, we've always been taught that we should secure the airway. In general, you want to secure the airway in a really sick kid, but in a sick DKA kid, things might be a little bit different. So what's the concern here?
Yeah, I think, you know, when these kids come in and they're really sick, so they really have tachypnea, they have those Kussmaul respirations, they're altered. I think the first reflex is, oh my gosh, we need to protect this kid's airway. And you might not even know that you're dealing with a DKA case at this time. It may be a new onset diabetes that you're dealing with. So in your ABCs, you're going to assess the airway. You're going to listen to their breath sounds. And I think that this may be the first clue that you're dealing potentially with DKA. If you listen to their breath, you have an extremely tachypneic patient and you listen to their breath sounds and they're perfectly clear. That might be because you're dealing with an acidosis. And in a pediatric patient, I would have high suspicion that we're dealing with DKA in the realm of acidosis. Next, you're going to, at some point in your ABC kind of initial assessment, you're going to get that finger stick. And then if that finger stick is high, like we said, over 200, then now you're thinking about DKA. And once I know I'm dealing with DKA, I'm going to really consider whether or not I want to go ahead and intubate this patient. Because remember, the reason why they're breathing so quickly and so hard is that they're trying to blow off as much CO2 as possible to try to keep their acid base level at a point where their body can function relatively normally, hopefully. So they may be breathing 30, 40 times a minute, and that's all they can do to keep compensated for the loss of bicarb that they're experiencing. So the last thing I want to do is paralyze that patient, put them on a ventilator and have them breathing 12 times a minute and cause their CO2 to build and them to become more acidotic and potentially cardiac arrest. Now, if I do really feel like they have to be intubated because they're just so altered that they are not protecting their airway, then there are some considerations to how you'd want to do this. First, I would have the most experienced intubator do it. It's probably not the airway that you want the intern to do on their first try. You want someone who's going to get it done pretty quickly.
All right, I know what you're thinking. It's frustrating that we keep saying that there's condition after condition in which the most experienced intubator has to do the intubation. And I promise you, one of these days, we're going to do an entire podcast on conditions where the least experienced intubator, I'm talking about the registration clerk out front, is the person who needs to do the intubation. I'm going to find conditions like that, and we'll talk about them. But for this month, unfortunately, the crashing asthmatic and the DK patient really are scenarios which are very tenuous, and the most experienced intubator should do the intubation. Sorry, we keep saying that.
Next, you could consider doing a non-paralyzed intubation. Maybe you just sedate with ketamine. That way you can keep their respiratory drive pretty high while you're intubating them and help them to compensate more. I've also heard, I have not personally done this, that you could place the patient on BiPAP for a little bit for their kind of pre-oxygenation. That'll help you really understand the type of tidal volumes they're pulling and the respiratory rate they're pulling. That way, when you do intubate them, then you can match the ventilator to what they were breathing before. So if they're breathing 35 times a minute before you intubated them, you want to set the ventilator to 30, 35 once you do intubate them. And then after that, all said and done, you want to get a VBG probably 30 minutes and then an hour after you intubate them to really make sure that you're helping them compensate at an appropriate level and they're not becoming more acidotic because of the treatment that you started for them.
Those are some really fantastic pearls. Well, let's move on to another really common concern that comes up whenever people talk about pediatric decay, and that has to do with the potential risk for cerebral edema. Now, I've heard that this can occur because of too much fluid, and I've also heard that this can occur because of overzealous correction of glucose with insulin, and I've also heard that this might occur because of bicarb administration. So what exactly is the truth about cerebral edema in these patients?
Yeah, I think historically, all of those things have been of concern, like you mentioned. I think first off, I'd like to talk a little bit about kind of recognizing the signs of cerebral edema. It's not something that I feel like I've seen a whole lot of in my career where these kids come in and they're overly concerning for cerebral edema. Remember, this happens in less than 1% of pediatric DKA cases and really is of very little concern in people over the age of 20. So it is a rare entity, I'd say. So some of the signs to look out for would be if the patient has posturing, if they have a cranial nerve palsy, you've been treating them for a while and all of a sudden they have a worsening altered mental status. If their heart rate suddenly dips down lower than anticipated for the amount of fluid resuscitation you've given them. Similar to worsening altered mental status, if they have worsening headache or vomiting despite being hours into their treatment or just seem more altered despite their DKA improving, those would all be signs concerning for cerebral edema and kind of get your ears perked up and looking out for that. I think also important to know is that cerebral edema is a clinical diagnosis. You can get head CTs on all these kids, and frequently they will be normal despite there being some signs of cerebral edema. And then the article talks a little bit about this entity called subclinical cerebral edema, which I personally had not heard of. So I looked into the study that they were basing this off of, and basically that there was a study where they took kids and they did an MRI on them while they were being treated for DKA before and after resolution. And it showed that while these patients were being treated for DKA, a significant number of them had some narrowing of their lateral ventricles, indicating that there was some evidence of MRI visible cerebral edema in these patients. And it was more prominent in kids with at least a little bit of altered mental status. So I found that really interesting that even the kids that we don't think that they're having cerebral edema, maybe they are having a little bit of this subclinical cerebral edema, and that's what's causing them to be altered. So to get back to your original question, now that we've talked a little bit about what cerebral edema is and how to recognize it, they do go into this article about how historically there was some concern that the type of fluid or the how rapid you gave fluid could cause cerebral edema. They quote that there was a multi-center randomized clinical trial that showed that the rate of fluid administration did not impact the rate of cerebral edema in these patients. So they were able to see in a very large population that no matter if they gave half normal saline, and no matter if they gave it fast or slow, it did not increase the rate of cerebral edema. They do mention another case control study where the only modifiable risk factor that did potentially provoke cerebral edema was the administration of sodium bicarb. So I would say in your DKA patients, even though these patients have a low bicarb level and they may be acidotic, you should really try to avoid giving sodium bicarb unless you feel like you really need to in the case of like a cardiac arrest, for example. So overall, I guess the take-home points I'm saying are don't feel bad if you have to give the patient an extra 10 cc per kg bolus of fluid because you think they need it. It should not hurt them, but I would say that you should continue to try to avoid sodium bicarb in these patients.
Great clarification. Now, if cerebral edema does develop, what exactly should we do for these patients?
So first things first, the easiest thing to do is go ahead and elevate the head of the bed. After that, you should get your nursing staff to pull out some mannitol or 3% sodium chloride for you. The mannitol dosing in this case is going to be 0.5 to 1 gram per kilogram, and your sodium chloride will be 5 milliliters per kilogram, and that's an infusion over 20 minutes. So either one of those is perfectly acceptable. You can just base it off of what you feel most comfortable with or what's easiest for you to get. And again, it's going to be an infusion over 20 minutes after you elevate the head of the bed.
Tonic saline that you're talking about?
Yeah, hypertonic saline, 3%.
All right. Well, that was a really great review. Are there any other key points that you'd like to throw in, perhaps that the article didn't emphasize, or just from your practice and what you've seen?
Yeah, so the article briefly mentioned when you could send kids home with DKA. And that was basically, they were saying if it wasn't considered to be severe DKA, so a pH of greater than 1.2, you could consider giving them their long-acting and short-acting insulin, rechecking their labs, and having them go home. I think that that's obviously a good strategy if the patient has good follow-up and it's not a new onset diabetes diagnosis for these patients. These patients with the new onset diabetes, they all typically need to come in the hospital to get a lot of diabetes education on how to use insulin and even just what diabetes is. Next, I just wanted to briefly discuss the window at which you do want to go ahead and get these patients off the insulin drip. So if once you've seen that your anion gap metabolic acidosis has resolved, you can go ahead and give that patient their long-acting insulin and then leave that insulin drip on for about 1 hour afterwards, and then you can turn it off. If you turn off the insulin drip before you allow that sub-Q long-acting insulin to really get in their system, you risk the patient going back into DKA. And then lastly, again, you mentioned the boarding issues that we've been experiencing. And with boarding, you may have more and more patients where you see them on an insulin drip for prolonged periods of time in the emergency department. If you have a patient where you see that their anion gap is closed, they no longer have ketones in their urine, but for some reason, their bicarb is still low, they still have a low pH, I want you to start thinking about whether or not this patient is having hyperchloremic metabolic acidosis. Remember, we've bolused this patient with normal saline. They've been on a normal saline infusion potentially for hours. So your acidosis at this point may just be due to the fluids you've been administering and not due to DKA, at which point the treatment is just to discontinue their normal saline. They don't need to be on an insulin drip anymore. They just need their normal saline to be turned off.
We're using, as you know, we're using a lot of plasmolyte and other types of fluids, Ringer's lactate, for example, which is not hyperchloremic or quite as acidotic as normal saline. Did they talk at all about what we refer to as balanced solutions, or are they still kind of going down the normal saline pathway in this article?
You know, I've noticed in our in the pediatric world, in the pediatric emergency department, in this article, they really do stick to normal saline or half normal saline. There's not a lot of mention of converting over to plasmolyte. And I'm not exactly sure why that is, but it seems like the two bag system in its heart just seems to be based off of normal saline.
All right. Well, maybe we'll have to get Dr. Winters and his focus on balanced solutions to talk to the pediatricians about this. All right. Well, fantastic. Spencer, that was a really great review of, I think, a very nicely written article and a very important article. Once again, Managing Diabetic Ketoacidosis in Children in Annals of Emergency Medicine, September 2021, almost hot off the press, I guess. And Spencer, once again, thanks so much for your time and attention. And I really hope to get you back on EMCast sometime really soon.
Thank you for having me. I look forward to it.
All right, folks, it's time for a quick summary of what we've talked about. We started out by talking about the crashing asthmatic, definitely a scary scenario. Now, normal asthma is not a big deal, and we take care of asthmatics presenting with mild to moderate exacerbations all the time, but these crashing asthmatics can be really scary, and about 2% of patients who present with asthma flare-ups will end up requiring intubation, and things get very, very hairy. Key points that Dr. Sutherland made: whenever patients present with wheezing, always consider alternative diagnoses. We get burned for always assuming that everybody with wheezing is asthma. We've missed patients with heart attacks and CHF. We've missed patients that come in with big PEs and pneumonias and other things like that. So think about the alternative diagnoses. And he also talked about using your point of care ultrasound to look for some of those other etiologies. Routine care, we know about that. Beta agonists, ipratropium, steroids, and so on. Epinephrine, when necessary. You throw some magnesium in for these patients. But for the refractory patient, consider non-invasive positive pressure ventilation. That CPAP or BiPAP, he talked about how those things work well. And if that's not doing the trick, and you do end up progressing to mechanical ventilation, first of all, when do you need to think about mechanical ventilation? Worsening tachypnea, worsening tachycardia, worsening diaphoresis, worsening agitation. Keep an eye on that mental status. And when you need to intubate the patient, of course, you want to get the most experienced intubator. You want to get that tube in absolutely as quickly as possible because these patients do not get pre-oxygenated effectively. And when possible, you want to try to use the largest endotracheal tube that you think is reasonable. Vent settings should be relatively low or focused on keeping the plateau pressures low. Keep the tidal volume about 6 to 8 cc's per kilogram. Use low respiratory rates. Even when that PCO2 is rising, you use low respiratory rates because this is an expiratory problem. You want to give the patient enough time to exhale. So starting out with respiratory rates, I'll oftentimes start at about 10 or 12 and then adjust the respiratory rate based on the subsequent gases. And permissive hypercapnia is okay. You want to keep the pH, ideally you want to keep the pH above 7.1, 7.2 or so. If the PCO2 is elevated but the pH is okay, that's okay. Once those steroids start kicking in, the airways open up, then things will start improving. But the last thing that you want to do is to use rapid rates, elevate the intrathoracic pressure, and pop a lung. That is a real disaster. So my thanks to Dr. Sutherland for a great review of the crashing patient. Next, we moved on to talk a bit about a high-risk condition in the emergency department, and that is when the patient wants to leave against medical advice or refusals of care. Dr. Kupusamy took us through this section. She notes that in the United States, about 1% to 3% of patients will leave against medical advice from the emergency department during these recent tough times. Those numbers are probably a bit higher. Now, we've always, I think, had an assumption that patients that leave against medical advice probably are doing so because they're just not that sick. But studies have shown that that's not true. Patients that leave against medical advice or without being seen have a higher risk of ED visit or revisit. They have a higher rate of admission, and they have a higher 30-day mortality. So these are not always just low acuity patients. Our job is to assess the patient's capacity, and remember that capacity is decision-specific, it's dynamic, it can change, and it is not obviated by intoxication. They can have alcohol on board and still be lucid enough to make a decision and leave against medical advice. And it doesn't have to be a decision you agree with or a good decision, but people have the right to make bad decisions. The AMA process is exactly that. It is a process. It's not just a piece of paper. Just having somebody sign a form and leave doesn't free you from the responsibility of taking good care of the patient and explaining everything to them. Dr. Kupusamy talked about this mnemonic, essentially just step-by-step through this mnemonic. You want to assess the severity of illness. You want to investigate or look into why the patient wants to leave and try to get the family on board whenever possible. Also, you want to mitigate or offer the maximal treatment for the patient as far as the patient will allow. Key point, you can't refuse care to the patient just because they don't want to go along with what you want to do. And I've seen patients who have been discharged, say, from the floors against medical advice, and the people upstairs refuse to give them antibiotics for pneumonia, for example. You can't do that. You have to give them as much treatment as possible up until the point that they start refusing. You want to explain all the risks, the benefits, and explain your point of view. And you also want to make sure to document really, really well. And the mnemonic that she uses is AIMED, A-I-M-E-D, assess, investigate, mitigate, explain, and document. Again, remember, the AMA process is not just a piece of paper. It is a full process. Now, if your hospital requires you to use the form, then use the form whenever possible. But make sure you're documenting that you went through the entire process. And remember that patients can refuse parts of their workup and still go along with other portions of their workup. And you can actually use that AMA form or process for the specific things that they're refusing. And we finished up our discussion with Dr. Spencer Lovegrove talking about diabetic ketoacidosis. 30% of kids who have their first presentation of diabetes will do so presenting in DKA. That's an astounding statistic. Signs and symptoms are very typical of what you look for in adults. Altered mental status, nausea, vomiting, polyuria, polydipsia, if they're really sick, Kussmaul respirations, and so on. Diagnostic criteria, glucose is going to be elevated, pH is going to be low, under 7.3 generally, and typically you'll see ketones in the urine or blood, acetone in the blood. Lab workup, chemistries, urinalysis to look for ketones, get a VBG to assess the acid-base status, and don't forget the EKG. The EKG is going to be your first tip-off to electrolyte disorders, especially potassium, and most importantly, looking for signs of hyperkalemia. Remember that in DKA, patients tend to be total body hypokalemic, but if they're very acidotic, what little potassium they have in their body may be shunted into the intravascular space, and so they can present with intravascular hyperkalemia, and that can kill them. So you're looking for peak T waves and YQRS and all the rest of the stuff on that EKG. You've seen it all too many times with bad outcomes. So get that EKG early on. In terms of treating the kids, start out with the 10 cc per kilo bolus of IV fluids. And normal saline is still pretty standard. They haven't gotten into the whole debate about normal saline versus plasmolite. We'll leave that for another time. Pay attention to potassium repletion. When the level's under 3.5, hold off on insulin and just start potassium replacement. When the level's 3.5 to 5.5, generally they say start the insulin and potassium together. And if the potassium level's over 5.5, hold off on potassium. Just go with the insulin. And make sure that if you are giving potassium for hypokalemia, you give the potassium before you start the insulin. Otherwise, that potassium is going to drop even further and you run into the possible consequences of hypokalemia, including arrhythmias. If a patient needs to be intubated, then you want to make sure, once again, it's an experienced intubator. You want to get that tube in really quickly. And you can try ketamine with these patients. You can consider awake intubation. And Spencer talked a little bit about this. Get the patient on a higher respiratory rate than normal. Asthma, we talked about low respiratory rate. With these patients, because they're Kussmauling, because they have a metabolic acidosis, they need a high respiratory rate so that they can continue to compensate for their metabolic acidosis. When do you turn off the insulin drip? Well, the acidosis needs to be resolved. You want to give the patient some long-acting insulin and then wait a couple of hours after the long-acting insulin before you discontinue the drip. And then Dr. Lovegrove spent the last few minutes talking about cerebral edema, which can occur in about 1% of DKA patients. The exact cause is still a bit unclear. One of the first things you're going to find out is that the patient is having some headaches long before they start having neurologic abnormalities, so pay attention to that. And also, the cause of cerebral edema is still somewhat unclear. It doesn't seem to be related to the fluid type or rate, but there are some studies that suggest that it may be related to or may increase in likelihood when patients are given sodium bicarb. What do you do for these patients? You're going to elevate the head of the bed. You're going to administer an osmotic agent, for example, mannitol or hypertonic saline, and you're probably going to get your neuro and neurosurgery folks involved as well. And my thanks to Dr. Spencer Lovegrove for giving us that update on pediatric diabetic ketoacidosis. And with that, we will conclude the February 2022 EMcast. I hope everyone out there is safe and healthy, and I look forward to talking to all of you next month. Bye for now.
Hey, thanks for listening to EMcast. And for listening to the end, here's a discount code for you. Use discount code PODCAST for 10% off each year of an annual subscription to eMedHome.com.